Hey everyone, it's Berlin Briefing Time, and today we'll be looking at Ukraine again. Why? Well, Donald Trump says he has a deal, and that basically it's Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky standing in the way. Trump says Zelensky is prolonging war in Ukraine by resisting calls to cede the Ukrainian peninsula Crimea to Russia. So today we'll be getting the perspective from Kyiv on that, but we'll also brief you on the German debate on the issue. Europeans, as you all know, have been trying to get more of a say in the discussions about how to reach a just peace for Ukraine. So what are the options? And which role will the next German government be able to play? And speaking of that, he's not quite in office yet, but the likely next German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, has reignited a familiar debate here. He's hinted at the possibility of sending some of Germany's Taurus cruise missiles to Ukraine. Will he? We all remember that the outgoing Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, refused to do that and said there were valid reasons not to do it. Well, to discuss all that, I have great guests with me. Today, over in Kyiv, we're joined by DW's very own Nick Connolly. Hi, Nick. Great you could make some time. And we also have Marina Miron on the line from King's College in London, a military analyst. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you, Michaela, for interrupting your Easter holidays to join me here in the studio. Michaela Kufner is, of course, a very familiar face and voice to you out there who are regular viewers and listeners of Berlin Briefing. So we'll start with you, Nick, over in Kyiv. We're recording on Thursday morning, of course, and we woke up to news that in Kyiv, where you are, authorities say there was another massive attack on the Ukrainian capital overnight, where 9 people were killed, more than 60 injured, including 6 children. What's the situation there right now?
Well, it was very, very loud and it went on for hours. You had kind of the initial wave with some ballistic missiles around kind of 1, 2 a.m. Then there were lots of the Shahed drones that you could hear very low over the city center, and then some more cruise missiles, it seems, and other attacks, but not ballistic missiles later on. A friend of mine who lives in the western suburbs of Kyiv said it was his worst night in 3 years of war. Certainly there'd been a bit of a lull recently in recent weeks and months. It really seemed like the Russians were kind of having to build up their stocks and collect these missiles to then kind of go big, because obviously Ukraine's air defenses are now good enough that they're normally able to deal with smaller attacks. So we're seeing fewer but bigger attacks. And, you know, this morning when you're walking the streets of Kyiv, you can even smell a bit of the kind of fires and that have been put out in the distance, that kind of heavy kind of scent of soot kind of around. So this is, you know, the impression for people have here is that this is Russia piling all the pressure and trying to kind of show people in Ukraine how vulnerable they are.
Yeah, and Marina, I want to throw that at you straight away. How does this latest attack by Russia fit into Russia's overall military strategy in Ukraine right now?
Well, good morning. What we know about the attack is very little at this point, but I think it's not very different from what we have seen in the past. And I think it's more of a continuation of Russia's military strategy rather than a deviation from the usual course. Because what we have to understand, we have the peace talks or peace negotiations, whichever way we want to call them, going on in parallel to the war. The war has not stopped. And so that's the problem here that we're having, is that despite the fact that there seems to be some sort of a force coming from Russia saying that they would potentially, at least according to leaked reports, freeze along the lines, the lines of contact, or they're willing to, we have these attacks going and they seem like out of place. But I would argue that it is nothing new and the Russians will continue as long as there is no peace deal signed or some sort of a peacekeeper force, whoever it might be, whichever parties it might be, controlling the ceasefire, and certainly a credible peace force that can also enforce punishments if needed.
And Michaela, Russia's attack came just hours after Donald Trump essentially lashed out at Volodymyr Zelensky in this Truth Social post where he said, you know, Zelensky's saying he will not cede Crimea to Russia, and Donald Trump saying, well, Zelensky is basically throwing out arguments there that are standing in the way of peace. Can you fill us in on where we're standing in that sort of an argument between Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky?
Well, basically, Trump has trapped Zelensky into a situation where Trump has taken on most of the Russian positions on this war in Ukraine. It's not just Crimea. It's about 20% of the territory of Ukraine, which would be under Russian control if Zelensky signed up to this. He is asked to accept that Crimea is essentially gone. That's actually what a lot of experts are saying behind closed doors, that they don't really see a path for Crimea returning. But Zelensky has been asked to do something that he cannot do according to Ukraine's constitution. And at the same time, he's asking Zelensky to do business, not just with the US, but also Russia in the energy sector. So this is a sellout that Zelensky cannot agree to, which traps him into a situation where he will have to say no. And we already saw J.D. Vance essentially saying, unless both sides accept that they stay where they are in this war, US will withdraw from the situation. Whether they will actually do it is another question. But this is really calling on the Europeans now to man up, to position themselves, and it could fast see them in a situation where they are asked to replace the United States, something Olaf Scholz, the still chancellor here in Germany, has already said that the Europeans simply cannot do. They can't do it militarily. Funding is also an issue, although that could be, there are solutions to that also by seizing Russian-owned money here in the EU. But this really is a pivotal point, and there is no easy way out for Zelensky. It could create more arguments for Donald Trump to simply abandon Ukraine and to withdraw military support, which would leave Ukraine exposed to a Russia that has already essentially changed its own economy to a war economy, whereas Europe continues business as usual, as unusual as it is, in the midst of a trade war that's brewing. So a very complex situation right now that is leaving Ukraine and particularly President Zelensky very exposed.
But Nick, in Kyiv, what was the reaction to Donald Trump's Truth Social post?
Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European current affairs programme, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge, bringing you a combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Join us every Thursday.
I think it's not unexpected, right? We have, you know, a situation where since that Oval Office bust up, we have a kind of impression among many Ukrainians that Trump is playing on the Russian team and that he is loath to criticize Russia, right? When you had that attack that killed so many civilians in Sumy, he was keen to say that it must have been a mistake by the Russians to take, you know, any opportunity to kind of take the burden of responsibility off them, and then on the opposite side, pile in and blame the Ukrainians for anything that annoys him. Coming back to what Mihaila said, I think there is a really easy alternative here. Obviously, the Russians want more, but the Ukrainians, even pre-2022, were willing to say, we are not going to try to retake Crimea by force. We are willing to park it like West Germany did with, you know, its territories after the Second World War. We will leave it to some time in the future, but recognizing it and saying, yes, this is Russia. Yes, international business can do trade with Russia in Crimea, you know, take off those banking sanctions. That is something that's just not going to happen. This is also, you know, a situation, Crimea is very present in Ukrainians' minds, right? You have lots of people who have fled Crimea who are here in Kyiv, they're especially the minority there, the Crimean Tatar population, that are under a lot of pressure from Russian security services, lots of them in jail. I think it's just a political impossibility for any Ukrainian president right now to say, yes, that's all Russian, here you go, we accept it. Because then the expectation is that, you know, a couple of years down the line, the Russians will expect the same for the occupied territories in eastern Ukraine, that Ukraine says, yes, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Luhansk, Donetsk, that's also Russia. Given a situation where you have, you know, President Putin basically saying that Ukraine is a historical mistake, an artificial country that needs to be brought back to the fold, there is a sense that if you agree to that on Crimea, that is just the beginning, and soon enough the rest of the country will find itself, you know, under Russian occupation, and then having that legitimized not only by Ukraine but the outside world just rewards that kind of aggression.
But, you know, we heard Donald Trump's spokeswoman say that the US president is losing patience, that enough is enough, and that things need to move on, or else the president himself will move on and will essentially focus his attention elsewhere. So all of these things that you and Michaela have just mentioned, Nick, they don't seem to be heard by the US administration, what is not possible for Ukraine to do. He wants to hear something that Kyiv is prepared to give. So what is Kyiv's strategy if they want to keep the US administration on board?
Well, I mean, right now, when you talk to political experts here in Kyiv, lots of them are just talking about kind of how best to manage that divorce, as it were, from Washington. Lots of people here basically have come to the conclusion that the Trump administration is going to check out sooner rather than later, and that it's now a question of damage limitation to make sure that kind of that divorce, as it were, happens on comparatively better terms, that, for instance, Trump doesn't stop US companies selling spare parts to Ukraine or allowing Europeans to pass on American-made equipment to Ukraine, that maybe, you know, there's no expectation that there are going to be new packages of US aid, but that on commercial terms it'll be possible that maybe some of the intelligence sharing might continue. I think there is a sense that, you know, Trump's mediation is not doing anything that is useful for Ukraine, right? There is no added value right now. One analyst off record put it to me yesterday. He said, if we wanted to capitulate, we don't need Donald Trump's help doing it.
Yeah. And of course, the US has also said that it could potentially lift the sanctions against Russia. So what should the Europeans do, Michela? Do you believe that the Europeans will show essentially self-confidence and say, but our sanctions will remain in place? We all remember that everything the Europeans have done in the last 3 years since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that has been in accordance with the US. So, you know, Europeans impose sanctions on Russia, the US imposes sanctions on Russia. If the US lifts those sanctions, will the European sanctions remain in place?
Well, it's struggle to imagine that the Europeans would simply drop them. I think this is a pivotal moment where the Europeans also have to become more independent from the United States. What is striking is that the way Donald Trump acts is as if he can afford to do whatever he likes. And that seems to be his outlook on geopolitics. But there are consequences that will haunt him. And he continues regardless of that. It undermines the credibility of the United States. I think it's most tangible when we see this trade war that he's picked, not just with China, but essentially the international way of doing a business of the world economy. And that is now coming back to bite him with the dollar becoming weaker, US bonds no longer being a safe haven for investors. And this shows that these actions that Donald Trump is boldly taking, that he's selling as taking back control in the United States, the US stopping a sellout, they have consequences. And we are probably months away from this having a real tangible consequences also for US security and its interests, particularly in Asia. Taiwan, of course, being the key issue there. If he abandons Ukraine, this is a very tough nut to crack for the Europeans, but they're not left without any options. There's some $300 billion in frozen assets, Russian money, essentially. There has been a hesitation for fears of undermining the credibility of the European Union for investors, but that clearly is eroding as we speak because the Europeans are running out of other options. But what that it leaves the very concrete concern of what Ukraine can do militarily without US support. That is the really tough challenge right now, because the Europeans, even when they throw everything they have into Ukraine, is potentially not going to be enough.
And that's where Marina comes in, of course. Marina, what can the Ukrainians do?
I just wanted to add something to what Michela said briefly, because I would like to approach the analysis of Trump's actions from a completely different perspective for the Trump administration, resolving the Ukraine issue, resolving the tensions with Iran, potentially with Russia's mediation, settling the Gaza matter is very important because the domestic problems are very grave within the United States. And this is something that the administration should turn attention to. So, from my understanding, this threat to withdraw from negotiations has also something to do with the fact that the situation domestically is very difficult and might boil over. And that's where the primary attention should be focused. And as far as Ukraine is concerned, well, it is very difficult because, yes, Nick has mentioned the sentiments within Ukraine and the issue with Crimea. Now, let's look at it from a practical perspective. What can Ukraine essentially do with the assets that it has at its disposal at this very point? How can it retake Crimea? And if we look at the 2023 counteroffensive and the state of Ukrainian forces at that time with the equipment that they had, right? So how many years or decades will it take for Ukraine to be capable of actually retaking Crimea by military force, right? So that is one question. The second question is, and as Michaela correctly said, the Europeans, for political reasons as well as economic reasons, do not have the capability to support Ukraine as much as Ukraine would like to and as much as Ukraine would need. Above all, Ukraine also needs manpower. It is not just weapons and spare parts that Ukraine needs. And so the question here is, what can Ukraine do in this situation? Because it is now sticking with the European approach, because the Trump approach is not favoring Ukraine in any shape or form. But is this approach going to essentially lead to the desired end state? Because my fear is here, while this all is going on, Ukraine is losing time. Yes, President Zelensky has extended the emergency rule, but essentially the fear here is that this might be decided on the battlefield before any sort of peace negotiations can take place or can cement some sort of an agreement between the two sides. And if that resolves militarily, most likely it will not be in Ukraine's favor. Then Ukraine will be in a much worse position. So I think it's very important for Ukraine or for Ukrainian leadership right now to consider what are the best options here. Because Ukraine is between a rock and a hard place. There is no good alternative. What's the least painful alternative for Ukraine right now to possibly stop the war? And who is going to take care of Ukrainian economy once it does? So that is another matter, because Ukraine is suffering a demographic crisis. So it's a very complex set of different factors when it comes to what choices Ukraine has at the moment, and whether taking Trump's deal, I'm not saying it's right morally or otherwise, but what is the lesser evil here when we look at the long-term outlook and the potential to rebuild Ukraine if and when the war ends?
I just, coming back to what Marina was saying, I think about Crimea, this is not about necessarily taking Crimea back. This is about the precedent, right? About not legalizing what Russia did, because this is about not only the territories that Russia has taken since 2022, but also potentially Russia coming back for another bite of the cake, because, you know, given what Putin's been saying, he is not done yet. There is still more Ukrainian territory that he thinks should be historically Russia's to take. So that's the first thing. As for the deal, you know, I agree with Marina, there is a lot of difficulty there, just keeping, you know, the ship going, keeping the economy upright, you know, trying to make things, even, you know, in the current kind of regime of war, carry on as it is. But I think the real kind of breaking point for any deal is the fact that this Trump peace plan has no real kind of provision for security guarantees, for some kind of guarantee to Ukrainians who are still here, that, you know,
lots of promises
5 years down the line, 2 years down the line, Putin won't come again. But there's no concrete promises of, you know, when the Europeans still haven't got their act together to suggest anything more concrete about peacekeepers or even shooting down missiles over Western Ukraine. I think if the deal as currently proposed happens, you are going to see the borders open and lots of the men who are currently in the country following their wives and kids to Western Europe and not coming back. So I think if there is a desire in Western Europe to see Ukraine not as a basket case, but as a kind of viable country, they need more than what's currently being offered to actually convince people that this is a country with a future.
We also need to talk about that Taurus cruise missile debate that Friedrich Merz essentially reignited. You know, Michael, if you could just sum up, this is a debate that here in Berlin was held last year already when Ukraine said it needs this long-range weapon in order to strike into Russian territory as well, essentially eliminating all the threats that, you know, military infrastructure, etc., where rockets are launched from Russian territory into Ukraine. And Olaf Scholz always said he has a very good reason not to send those Taurus cruise missiles.
Well, in a nutshell, Olaf Scholz fought a re-election campaign, which he lost, on the ticket of being a chancellor who reflects and who doesn't recklessly simply hand over all weapons Germany has. There are similar British and French systems which are already being used by the Ukrainians, but the German Taurus system, if you ask any expert, is the best system and the system of choice. Volodymyr Zelensky is very keen to get that particular weapons system in order to exactly do that, break up supply chains, also weapons depots. Friedrich Merz, as he approaches power, has continued to be a lot more cautious. He says he will send it in if allies agree and do the same thing.
Yeah, we have that clip. Let's listen to what Friedrich Merz said.
I've always said I would only supply Taurus in coordination with our European partners. They are already supplying cruise missiles. The British and the French are doing it, the Americans are doing it anyway, so if it's coordinated, then Germany should participate.
So, a yes but, a clear yes but. Now we're at a situation, look, if the Americans stopped supplying their system, what would the Germans do? He's not even elected as chancellor. And this is part of the problem, actually.
But that will happen soon. On the 6th of May, he'll get elected.
Yes, that will happen very soon, but he's not in power yet. And that decision cannot be taken by Olaf Scholz, who's still essentially in a caretaker position. And these are the key...
And wouldn't be taken by Olaf Scholz.
Well, these are the key days and weeks where that decision has to be taken.
Yeah. Marina, can you just give us a reminder, why does Ukraine say it needs the Taurus cruise missile? What is so special?
Well, the Tauruses are much newer than the Scalp Storm Shadow iterations that Ukraine has at its disposal. One interesting thing about the Tauruses is their range, the 500-kilometer range, which is almost twice as much as the current arsenal has that Ukraine has at its disposal. Another interesting feature is the warhead that it has. So this warhead was specifically designed to destroy critical infrastructure. That is why President Zelensky was talking about the Kerch Bridge, or was it the head of work, Kirilla Budanova? I don't remember, but the talks were there that these missiles could be used to destroy that vital link between Russia and Crimea. They are called bunker busters. And these are cruise missiles, which, you know, their downsides because they're much slower when they're traveling at subsonic speeds, Mach 3, if I'm not mistaken. So they can be intercepted, but they are also smart and have several different navigation systems, not just GPS, meaning that it will be very difficult to jam them. And then they can evade the likes of ground-based air defenses. So the chance of hitting the target with a missile like that is much higher, which is, of course, then problematic for the Russians because they would have to readjust their air defenses to be able to intercept Tauruses. And we have seen this technological competition inside Ukraine going on, each side trying to outpace the other side, specifically in the domain of drones and electronic warfare and laser weapons when it comes to countermeasures for drones. So for Ukraine, it would be a sign, of course, that Germany is willing to support it because we remember the Leopard debate. So on the morale side, that would add to that. Will it add to military capabilities? Well, depends. Depends on when these missiles will arrive and in what numbers. Because if Germany gives Ukraine 10 missiles, then and these missiles arrive sometime in October next year, I wouldn't hold my breath if I was Ukraine. And we heard again, this is a political statement. Well, we will supply the missiles, but, right. So what is going to happen? Friedrich Merz will need the majority. So there will be a vote again when it comes to the decision whether to supply these missiles. And I'm not talking even about logistics, about outfitting the airframes to be able to carry them and so on and so forth, sustainment, maintenance, all those things. It's not just you just send those missiles to Ukraine and tick the box and say that's done. There are so many other things that have to be taken into account. But the problem is that when we hear such statements, yes, but if we get that doesn't give me a good feeling, shall we say, when it comes to the prospect of Ukraine receiving a significant number of these missiles in order to make a strategic difference on the battlefield.
And we have to remember that they're very expensive systems. They also don't exist in huge numbers in Germany. We have several hundreds of them, but only about 150 or so could be used right now. That's what military analysts here in Germany are saying. And, the maximum that Ukraine could received from Germany is estimated to be around 100, but that is a huge, huge cost as well for the new German government. So that would be a tremendous commitment by Germany to do that. And I just want to ask Nick on that. Nick, by saying that Ukraine needs those cruise missiles, when everything that we've heard in this discussion, but also in general about the prospects of Ukraine actually winning, when they're so slim, is Ukraine's idea to essentially buy itself some time with state-of-the-art weapons like this?
I mean, I think we have to quickly just kind of remind ourselves that, what is winning, right? I mean, the one winning is obviously going back to the 1991 borders, taking back Crimea. That is not on the cards anytime soon. But winning right now seems like, holding the front lines for longer, seeing Russian losses really go up, and they have been very significant. And end of last year, we thought the Russians were imminently going to take a place like Pokrovsk, and they still haven't done that months down the line. So there is a significant cost to what Russia is doing. And I think the Ukrainian vision of winning right now looks a lot more like holding out till a better deal is possible, till the Europeans get their act together and provide serious security guarantees, till a kind of serious also commitment to provide weapons in future if there's not going to be NATO membership, but then, bilateral security deals that actually mean something and actually have real kind of hard and fast commitments. So I think that's the one thing. As for the kind of debate on tariffs, I spent the last couple of days talking to experts here. Some of them, bring up the same arguments that Marina did about the kind of value, especially for attacking that Crimean bridge and cutting off Russian logistics there. Ukraine's obviously tried to attack that bridge with other means, and it hasn't, fully. It's maybe put it out of action for a while, for a couple of hours or a day or two, but not fully. So that is obviously important. But I think there is also the kind of other perspective on this, that this has just become a kind of symbol, and that Ukraine basically, can give up on expecting this actually to happen, but just keep on asking the Germans. And then in return, the German leadership, be that Merz or Scholz before him, can tell their more skeptical party members, members of parliament, look, I'm responsible. I'm not going to take risks. I'm not going to make us a party to this war. I won't send tourists, but I will send all this other stuff. And that by asking for this difficult thing, Ukraine's basically creating kind of political space for Germany's leaders to then find more money for things like Patriot air defense systems that are politically less problematic, but also cost a lot of money. So that this basically becomes this kind of proxy situation where, Germany is constantly saying no, but then offering alternatives.
Yeah, and of course, Russia is essentially also already reacting to this debate about the Taurus cruise missiles, and maybe we can just listen to what a Russian spokeswoman said on the issue when she heard that this debate was coming back to the Berlin stage.
A strike using these Taurus cruise missiles on Russian critical infrastructure will be assessed as the Federal Republic of Germany directly participating in military action on the side of the Kyiv regime, with all the consequences for Germany.
Yeah, and Russia's top security official, Shoigu, has already also doubled down on that and said, we would reserve the right to use nuclear weapons if Western weapons were used to attack Russian territory. Or also, he mentioned Belarus.
Yes, ask any Baltic leader. They will tell you, just one second, they will tell you that Russia is very good at creating fear in any society.
And using that nuclear threat.
If you look at the polling here in Germany, there is still an underlying assumption that Germany is in no way party to this, although security experts are speaking already of a hybrid conflict that we're in, shying away from using the word war. And this statement also from the Kremlin turns the logic of Friedrich Merz on its head. During the election campaign, he said, and he's still likely the next chancellor, he said that he sees a Taurus as a weapon that could be delivered unless Russia stops destroying critical infrastructure in Ukraine, because the Russians are going after energy supply, after also there were these attacks on hospitals, so civilian targets. And this is what Friedrich Merz I feel like saying back then, said should be the bargaining chip to turn the dynamic on its head with Russia. This feels very dated as we sit here and speak about it right now. So there's still a huge space between that rhetoric and what will actually happen on the ground. But clearly, this is a fear that exists here in Germany and that impacts a German public, and that will therefore influence how any chancellor and Olaf Scholz. He made it his signature policy not to deliver the Taurus system, but he's also not facilitating any training on the Taurus system, because it would take months for Ukrainian troops to get trained on this before it could even be delivered and then used in Ukraine. So it just shows that there's a huge gap between this rhetoric and what will then become political action.
And Nick, you wanted to add something?
I just want to say that with these kind of statements from people like Maria Zakharova, the foreign ministry spokesperson there, I think you need to take a significant pinch of salt. Yeah. These are people who, as Michaela said, are trained to try and sow kind of panic or work on those fears in Germany. I mean, I think it's also interesting if you look at the kind of rhetoric that's been coming out in the recent weeks. We've had basically Russian state propaganda talking about rapprochement with America and that Eurofascism is now the problem. You had kind of Second World War style cartoons of Ursula von der Leyen as this kind of militaristic enemy of peace in Ukraine, who's kind of telling the Ukrainians to keep dying, keep fighting. So the kind of propaganda machine has now decided that America is no longer the problem, and it's now Europe that is the party of war. I think we're going to have to expect more of this in the coming weeks.
Yeah. Just briefly, what should have we been expecting from Russia to say, sure, send those missiles, we're happy. It is kind of a logical response, and we have heard that before. What we have to understand, and to build on Nick's point, is that there is another dimension to this war, and this is the information war that has been going on for much longer than even, say, 2014. And if you look at the First World War, Second World War, in any war, governments use information for their political objectives. And we have to be careful, because it's not the information that we officially hear that might be harmful. It is information operations that are being conducted inside Europe. And I think that is a bigger threat. And so what is essentially created is a big cloud from the top of this kind of, yes, we just you dare to send those missiles. So we focus our attention not where we should be focusing our attention. And I'm talking about internal security of European countries.
Yeah, and information war is something that we'll definitely do a Berlin briefing episode about in the next weeks to come. But of course, we'll also have to look at how the next German government is actually forming. I've already said it on the 6th of May, we're going to see the election, very likely election of Friedrich Merz as the next German Chancellor, and then we'll know who the cabinet members are. We'll give you a full briefing on what we know about who's going to be positioned in which ministry, etc., as soon as we have those details. But do send us your comments. We're on YouTube, we're on all the major podcast platforms, and we're also on TV at DW News. So thank you very much for watching and for listening wherever you are. Hi again, Nina here with a quick update. We recorded this episode in Berlin at 9 a.m. Central European Summer Time on April the 24th, which was 3 a.m. in Washington, D.C. And while we were wrapping up post-production, we noticed that U.S. President Donald Trump had been active online. He wrote, and I quote, "Vladimir, stop. Capital letters and exclamation mark included. I am not happy with the Russian strikes on Kyiv. Not necessary and very bad timing," end of quote. That's quite a statement. But hey, this is the challenge we podcasters often face. You risk missing real-time developments related to your story. So despite this, we've decided to upload the episode as it is. And while I'm here again, I'd like to thank the amazing team behind Berlin Briefing, producers and editors Zura Karolashvili, Ben Semke and Mike Koch, as well as our executive producer Rosalia Romanets. Till next time.